Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Spirit Travels Radio. I'm Karen Miles, and this is my dear friend and co-host, Jolene. Hi, Jolene.
Hi. How are you this evening?
I'm doing pretty good. I want to tell everybody that we may be experiencing a little bit of tech difficulty because I can hear it on my end. Hopefully, it's not going on where everybody else can hear it. But I just wanted to say that we have a really good show in store. We're going to be bringing Adrian Lee on this evening, and very interesting. So if you're ready, Jolene, we'll just go ahead and get started.
Oh, yes. Let's begin our program and enjoy it.
Okay, sounds good. Well, okay. Everybody, I'd like to welcome Adrian Lee. Hi, Adrian.
Hello, ladies. How are you this evening?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
Fabulous. That was an amazing intro, by the way. That sounds like Johann Sebastian Bach if he had access to electricity.
Oh, well, we hope that we try our best to produce the best show that we possibly can. And like I said, my music, when it came across today, it was not, I could hear the tech issue on this end. But anyway, thank you so much for those words. Would you mind telling us a little bit about you?
Sure. Yeah, you've probably recognized by now that I have an English accent. I'm currently residing in Minnesota, up here in the chilly north, but originally I was born in London. And I'm a historian. I studied history. I've lectured history all over Europe. I've lectured in London. I've lectured in Cologne, in Vienna. I lectured for 15 years. I actually worked for the British government at one point as a curriculum advisor, advising as part of a government team how education should be put together in Britain. And my specialism originally was art history. I'm an art historian. But progressively, if you have skills as a historian, you can actually use them as transferable skills to then study any other methodologies and any other history once you have those skills in place. But I've got an East London accent. If anyone was listening from London, they'd know instantly I came from the East End of London just by my accent, which is slightly different to the South of London or to the West of London, in the same way that the people in this country could probably tell the difference from, you know, different sides of New York in the subtleties there. But I studied history, and I've researched my family tree recently, and I've gone back as far as 1585, and my family are still living in London. So I guess if you cracked me open, I'd have the word London running through me, I guess. But I first got interested in the paranormal due to some childhood incidents that happened to me. My parents moved into a house in 1983 when I was 13. And my sister got first choice of the rooms. And she chose one of the bedrooms, you know, that was on the other side of the house. And my sister's name is Joanne. And we call her Jo, of course, as a shortening of that. And in the first week we lived in this house, my sister was woken up every night by a man's voice shouting out, Jo, so loud that it woke her up, and it scared her. So the first morning after that happened in the middle of the night, she spoke to my dad and myself and said, did you call me in the night? There was a man's voice calling me, and it woke me up. And, of course, neither of us, you know, were involved in that incident. I was asleep, and my dad wouldn't be calling out in the night. And each evening, each night of that week we first moved into this house, she was woken up by a man's voice calling out, Joe. And me and my sister have the kind of relationship that most brothers and sisters have, where we're close, but, you know, we'd be hitting over the head each other with golf clubs and hockey sticks at the first opportunity my parents have their back turned. And it was unusual for me one morning to wake up and find my sister sleeping on my bedroom floor with her blanket wrapped around her. She was too scared to go back into her room. Subsequently, you get mail delivered to your house from the previous occupant, of course, and we had a forwarding address. But the old lady that lived in the house before we moved in, the reason she moved is because her husband died. And we were told by the neighbours that her husband died in my sister's room. That was the room he died in bed. So my sister became obviously slightly more distressed about that. What was the kind of caveat to that story is that we had some mail delivered to our house, and that was for this old lady whose husband had died. And we discovered her name was Josephine, and everyone used to call her Jo, apparently. So what had transpired is her husband had died in my sister's bedroom, what was then my sister's bedroom, and the husband was calling out for his wife, and his wife was Josephine, and everyone called her Jo. And my sister, who was Joanne, obviously thought they were for her, so that really caused her some issues. And then there was various moments throughout my childhood where I'd see shadow people walking through the house out of the corner of my eye, and there'd be occasions when I'd be walking home from school and I'd see someone standing in the window of her house, you know, looking out, and I'm thinking it's one of my parents or my sister, and I'd walk into the house and there'd be no one in the house. I'd be the first one home. And there was other occasions where you'd be walking up the path to the house and the outside light would go off and you'd be cursing your luck because you can't find the keyhole to put your key in the lock to open the door. So you're thinking the bulb's gone. So you open the door in the dark, fumbling around. You make it to the outside light to turn it back on or to see whether the bulb is gone, and the light comes back on. The switch had been thrown from the inside as I was walking up the path, but no one was in the house. So throughout my childhood, there were experiences that were difficult to explain, and there was moments where, you know, as a young child, you were reading books from the library on the paranormal and trying to understand what's going on. And of course, as a young child, you know, you go to the library, if you're the type of person I am, you'll be getting books out on the Loch Ness Monster and the Yeti and UFOs and all the things that boys like to read about at that age. But what happened to me in terms of my paranormal career, I was lecturing and teaching, and I started working with a group based in the north of London. They're about an hour north of London in a town called Luton. And a team in Luton called the Luton Paranormal Society, I started working with. And what I discovered is that because I'm a historian, I have the research skills, so I'm a really useful member to have on a team. because I'm the type of person that could very easily go and find out who owned the house. I could find out who died in the house, all the previous people that had stayed there when the house was built, and the things that historians are good at finding, I guess. And of course, if you have the names and you have the information and things come through psychically or information comes through on the equipment we're using, obviously you can verify that. But it's also a very powerful tool. If you can go into a building and the person who built that building, their name has been lost to the knowledge of man, and then you can utter that name again in that building, and it's the first time it may have been heard in 150 years. And if that spirit was residing in that building at that point, you know, it's a stimulus for them and a catalyst for them to come forward. So as a historian, the history books I write, I wasn't there. None of us were there. And historians can just write about what they think happened based on collating all the information and evidence they can find. And it's their interpretation, it's their theories of what happened. And history moves in a very linear line. And so if you write an essay or you write a book about a certain aspect of history, it's your opinion based on the facts you've found. What progressively then happens is that someone else will come along after you and write another essay or another book that'll be the opposite of what you've written. So when those two come together, there's a thesis that you write, and then there's an antithesis which the next historian who comes along will write, and then a historian in the future will take both those texts and make a synthesis of the two, and that's Hegelian art theory or history theory methodologies. So I want to try and be as accurate as possible. Well, it became apparent to me that as I'm investigating around London and I'm investigating around England, bearing in mind a lot of our buildings and churches, for example, date back 1,000 years, it was obvious to me that I could start interviewing people that had died. I could start talking to the dead, talking to the spirits via my psychic skills and other psychic skills, plus the equipment we've got. And what a gift to be able to interview someone from 200 years ago that's dead, to actually ask them what it was like and ask them details and ask them for dates and names and things that you can possibly be aware of. And you're almost interviewing them and finding primary source material. So the work I'm doing at the moment and the book I've got out at the moment is based around the state that I'm living in at the moment, which is Minnesota. And it could be any state. I don't want people to think this book is solely for people based in Minnesota. It's a book about theories on ghost hunting. It's a book about theories that have never been seen before and why these things happen and how things take place in the paranormal, which is unique and backed up with evidence. It just happens that it is Minnesota because that's the state I find myself living in. So it's the context into which I apply all the theories and all of the ideas that I have to see if they work. And, of course, if I'm interviewing ghosts and I'm interviewing spirits, then obviously all that's in the book. And anything a ghost or anything a spirit says to me in terms of the ghost box or in terms of the ovulus or my psychic skills, I don't take for read. I'd be laughed at by other historians and my peers if I took that information and just published that without checking it first. But progressively, what's happened in the last 4 years when I've been writing this book is the information they've given me has given me a chance to go to the historical societies, go to newspapers and archives. And if it gives you a name to look for, it gives you a specific date to look for, that narrows your research down. And I found 100% of the time the information they've given me has turned out to be true. So now when I'm investigating and I'm given information and I can't find it, I'm of the impression that it's just because I've not found it yet rather than it's not true. Because information I've been given in the past may have taken me a year to 2 years to actually find, because there's so much research, so many pages of newspapers you have to turn, that, you know, some of the information I'm given has taken me that long to catch up with it in many respects. And I have examples of that. There's a big building here called the Schmidt Brewery. And when the Germans emigrated to America in the 1850s, 1860s, due to the revolutions taking place in Germany and political instability, they brought with them lagering techniques and techniques of brewing that Americans hadn't seen before. So a lot of beers, a lot of brewing techniques, especially in the Midwest, were brought over by German immigrants. And one particular family, the Schmidt family, built a brewery in St. Paul, and it's a fabulous building. It looks like a cross between Gotham City and Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. It's the most incredible-looking building. If you're a fan of architecture, I recommend you look up the Schmidt Brewery in St. Paul. It's a fabulous-looking building. And it's disused now. They haven't brewed beer there for about 10 years, but the place is boarded up. But my team and myself, I'm the founder of the International Paranormal Society, and my team and myself went in there to do an investigation. And we were in the darkest part of the basement where all the vats of beer were stored. I had a gentleman come through to me in spirit who told me his name was Matthew and that he was a fireman and he died down there. So I'm writing this information down. It took me nearly 2 years to find this particular gentleman. So as I said previously, if I can't find the information, it's just that I haven't found it yet rather than it's not true in my experience. I found a copy of the St. Paul Globe, which was the local newspaper at the time. And there on the 16th of April, 1904, I found a column which discusses the death of a gentleman called Matthew Kohler. Now, one of the reasons I had trouble finding him was that he said he was a fireman. So naturally, I assumed he was a firefighter. So I've been doing searches for fires that had taken place in the Schmidt Brewery and explosions. And I even considered the concept that during Prohibition, I know for a fact that the local fire service and the local police service actually used to go into the brewery and they had a small little room at the back where they used to drink illegally. And they literally had a tap running through the wall where there's a big vat of beer on the other side and then a tap going through the wall so they could take the alcohol straight out of these giant vats. So I'd been kind of looking in the wrong places to a certain degree. What he was a fireman, but a fireman back in the day was someone who went around at twilight and they lit all the gas lamps and they lit all the furnaces so they could carry on working, you know, in an age where there wasn't electricity. In the same way that the person who shovels all of the coal into a locomotive is called the fireman. And so what had happened was he'd spilled oil on himself from the gas lamp and then accidentally caught himself on fire and they couldn't put him out. And he died a day after he caught himself alight, partly due to inhaling actual flames. But he had burns all over his body, and he must have been in a lot of agony. And they say that you can leave a footprint behind if your death has been very agonizing or it's been a traumatic experience. But there, you know, you can imagine the hairs standing up on the back of my neck when a spirit tells me his name and that he was a firefighter, or a fireman, should I say, and that he died down there. And then as a historian, 2 years after that incident, I finally get my man and I find him. And it turns out to be true, and all the details are there. So that's the premise of the whole book, and all the history and all the evidence in the book is being brought to the fore by those kind of experiences.
Wow. So with all the investigations that you've done, which one touched you the most? Which one has stayed with you?
There's different investigations that stayed with me for different reasons. As a paranormal investigator, of course, the one thing you want to be seeing is a ghost. And so there's been occasions where I've seen ghosts. Others have stayed with me because they've been profound or very emotional for me. And others, you know, stay in the memory because members of my team were physically attacked. So, you know, if we work our way through some of those, there's a building that's a couple of hours' drive north of Minneapolis, and it's called the Palmer House Hotel, and it's in a town called Sauk Center. And Sauk Center is famous for Sinclair Lewis being born here, and Sinclair Lewis was a writer in the 1920s and 30s, and he was the first American ever to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. So the town gets visited for literary reasons, and academics and tourists are often in Sauk Center. Well, the Palmer House Hotel was built in 1901, and it's a fabulous Art Deco building. It has all the original tin ceilings. It has the wooden floors. It has a fabulous cedar staircase. It's got stained glass windows that were imported from Vienna. In fact, the local population thought that when it was first being built, they thought it was a church because they'd never seen a building outside of a church that had stained glass windows before. So this is a fabulous building. Before the building was built, there was another pioneer hotel here that was made of wood, and that was actually built in 1863. So before that hotel, there was a hotel on the site. And what happened to me, I was investigating in the bar, and it was a dark area, and I was with a film crew at the time, and I'm standing behind the actual bar itself where the barman would be standing. And if you've done any length of paranormal investigating, you'll certainly be aware that you start to get used to the kind of changes in the atmosphere and subtle things taking place that make you aware that something's going to happen. So members of my team now are so experienced, you know, a minute before something appears or a minute before something takes place, you're almost aware of it just through the barometric changes that are taking place in the room. So at the other end of the bar, maybe 20 feet away from me, I can see that something's starting to form. And while this is taking place, all my equipment is going nuts. My K2 meter's flickering up and down. I've got all kinds of things beeping. So I know the EMF and the electromagnetic fields in the room have changed and something's arrived. So I'm standing at one end of the bar. At the other end of the bar, a humanoid figure starts to appear. And it looks like, if you imagine a really cold, frosty morning, and we have one or two of those in Minnesota, if you imagine turning the ignition on a school bus and seeing that first really dirty, dark grey puff of smoke that comes out the back of the exhaust pipe on a diesel vehicle, it kind of looked like that. It was a really dirty, grey kind of smoke, and it starts to form into the shape of a person. And then it starts walking towards me directly, and it's getting closer. You know, it was started 20 feet away, and it's got to 15 feet, and it's got to 10 feet. And I'm standing there thinking, well, what does one do now? You know, you spend all your life, you know, looking for ghosts, and suddenly one's appeared and it's walking towards me. And you have that split second, you know, that the caveman used to have of fight or flight. You know, your basic instinct at that point is to run away. But, you know, having investigated for so long and as a lifestyle decision, spent many, many moments in basements in the dark and cold and wet, you know, this is the opportunity you wait for and the thing that you go out to see. So I clenched my fists, I gritted my teeth, and I sat there thinking, well, what's the worst it can do? So it's walking towards me, and I think it probably gets about 10 feet away from me, and it starts to dissipate, almost like cigar smoke, and you're wafting your hand through it, and it starts to disappear. And I tell you what it reminded me of. I don't know if you're big fans of Star Trek, but do you remember the really early episodes of Star Trek in the 60s where they had trouble with the transporter and you could see the person kind of fading in and out as Scotty tried to bring them on board? It kind of looks a bit like that. So this disappears. And I'm standing there thinking, well, what happened there? Because your left-hand side of the brain's thinking, wow, you've seen a ghost. And the right-hand side of your brain is saying, no, that can't possibly happen. That's silly. That's ridiculous. Science suggests that can't possibly have taken place. So I'm standing there kind of chewing on this for a few seconds, and suddenly it appears again, but just a couple of feet away from me, to the point where I have to take a step back, and the whole thing's forming again into a humanoid shape, and now it's looking at me in the face from a couple of feet away. And again, I'm standing there thinking to myself, well, what can it do? What's the worst it can do at this point? And again, for a second time, it dissipated like cigar smoke and disappeared and didn't come back again. And I turned round to the film crew I had with me, and I said to them, did you see that? And they all stood there with their jaw on the floor, so I know they'd picked it up. Unfortunately, the room was so dark that, you know, on their IR camera, you didn't get a sense of that grey smoke because it didn't project the heat. It didn't get picked up on the cameras, but the whole film crew saw that. So, you know, if you're talking to me about a moment that kind of was defining, that was a moment where I'd actually seen an entity and I didn't run. And, you know, there might be other times in my career where I get taken by surprise and I do run. But at that moment, you know, I was brave enough to kind of grit my teeth and face that off, if you like. The thing that followed after that was the owner of that hotel, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, back in the 1970s and early 80s, wrote a book of his experiences of running a hotel in the Midwest. And as you can imagine, many, many strange things go on in hotels. And he wrote this journal, which got published. And if anyone can get a copy of it, it's very rare now. It's called The Corner of Main Street. And the manager and the owner of the hotel was called Al Tingley. Halfway through the book, I managed to pick this book up on eBay, And I was reading his journals just from a historic perspective to see, you know, what was in there from a history point of view. And this was 3 months after this event where this apparition appeared. And I think it was chapter 9. I started reading in bed one night just before I went to sleep. And as I'm reading it, he starts discussing the fact that on the first floor, back in the early 1970s, he saw a grey, smoky, humanoid figure, and those were his words as well, walking down the corridor towards him. And then he goes on to list all the members of staff, all of the guests in the past, in the 50s and 60s, that had seen that as well. And that was just a joy for me, because I'd seen the apparition without having any previous knowledge that this apparition existed in this form. And then 3 to 4 months after the event, I then have an affirmation that what I saw was real, because other people had documented that, you know, 30, 40 years before me. So that was really quite something for me, and the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up, you know, as I read that. To carry on the story of the Palmer House Hotel, one of the main reasons I started writing the book was due to this particular incident. This was my catalyst for making a start on this journey of writing this historical haunted document, was that the staff and the customers in this hotel had often said over the years that they'd seen a small boy playing on the stairs. He was a child of maybe about 5 to 6 years old with blonde hair, and there was talk of him having a ball and bouncing a ball and running up and down the stairs. And various staff had seen him, guests had seen him, and he was kind of like the urban legend, the urban myth for that hotel. And as a historian, I thought to myself, well, if anyone died there, there must be a record of that. This is such a small town that back in the day, there was only 300-400 people living in Sauk Centre. And if you look at the local newspaper, and we're very privileged in Sauk Centre as a historian, that they've got every newspaper here from 1867 onwards. So there's a full record of everything that took place. So I started looking through page by page all of the local newspapers from that period, and they're all very delicate, and you have to wear the white glass, and it's all properly supervised. You can't just go down there willy-nilly. You have to, you know, do things properly. They're such rare documents, these newspapers from that period. And sure enough, you know, what you've got to bear in mind is if anyone died or if anyone was murdered in the town, you can be sure that's front page news, because the newspapers back then were just a couple of sheets of paper folded in half, and no word of a lie. When I first started going through them, they'd have headlines like Mrs. Smith's carrots are doing really well this year, or, you know, Mr. Smith finds notebook and wallet in the street, please come to the office to collect it, kind of thing. So, you know, a murder or a death would be very prominent. And sure enough, I hadn't spent too long, you know, dipping into these documents. And there in August 1868, it said that there was a Professor Sands staying at the hotel. He was a travelling lecturer, and he had a son whose first name wasn't mentioned in the actual column, but he was called Master Sands. And it said a 5-year-old Master Sands had fallen down the stairs and he'd cracked his skull open and subsequently died. And so what took place for me was quite phenomenal. That was a real turning point for me, that story had been in place. People had seen that. People had acknowledged that there was a small boy on the stairs, but had no previous knowledge that boy, or a boy, had died there, because that had been lost to the knowledge of man. That was information that I dredged up and discovered maybe 120, 130 years, you know, after it had long been forgotten about. So those sightings must be real. If I'd have said to you there's a ghost of a boy on those stairs, and then a week later you said I've seen the ghost of the boy, a psychologist would suggest that I'm implanting that information, and you're then using it, or your brain is working with that information to make that sighting for you. And there's been cases in Britain where people have made up ghosts and done psychological tests, and they've made up a ghost, and then during the course of the week, you know, that ghost gets written about in the newspaper, and then people write into the newspaper saying they've seen that ghost when it was an act of fiction. This time round, no one knew of that story. No one had any knowledge that a boy had died on those stairs, and there I dredged up the historical evidence to say that it was actually true. So again, if you're looking for moments where I've had a kind of emotional experience, or I've had something happen to me that sticks with me, that those incidents in the Palmer House are things that I'd want to kind of bring up. And if you don't mind me carrying on talking, I can bring up some other incidents that have stuck with me for different reasons. There's a fabulous theatre in East Side St. Paul in the cities, and it's an Art Deco theatre from the 1920s, 1922 it was built, and it's, again, one of the chapters in my book, the same as the Palmer House. And it was a typical theatre stroke cinema at the time. The films of that era are obviously black and white and silent, and they had vaudeville acts, and people would pay, you know, just a couple of cents, and they would go to the theatre, and it was very working class, and it was a place for people to meet. It even got turned into a soup kitchen during the Depression, so it was an area where people would congregate and talk and be with one another. I took a team into the basement, and was standing in the basement, and one of the ladies on my team is the type of person who's very sceptical. She's very down to her. She actually works as an undertaker, so there's no drama with her. She's seen many, many things in her life, and she's not going to jump to conclusions. And she's the type of person that always says, "Nothing ever happens to me." Well, you need to be careful what you wish for sometimes, and this is a warning to anyone who's listening, is that on that particular evening, she got grabbed by the throat by an unseen force that we couldn't witness, and it threw her to the floor and started beating her up. And because we're in Minnesota and because it's minus 40, you know, some nights in the winter here, whenever we go on investigations, you know, we dress up warm, especially if you're going to be plodding around basements in the dark and cold, you know, with water dripping from the ceiling. So this lady had a snow jacket on, and she had a woolly hat, and, you know, we were well wrapped up. And there's one thing about investigating in Minnesota that I've not experienced in my investigations anywhere in the world, and that's the Minnesota sniff, which basically means that if you're running a DVR and you're listening to EVPs, when you say, "Is anyone there? Can you give me a sign?" you can be guaranteed that one of your members of your team goes and starts sniffing. So that's the Minnesota sniff that ruins all my EVP sessions. So this woman gets dragged out of the basement. We take her upstairs to the auditorium. And she said, "My body feels strange. It feels like I've been scratched or attacked. It feels really sore." So the lady, you know, keeping her dignity, of course, lifted up her, snow jacket and lifted up her blouse on her back. And she had scratch marks all over her body. And the chilling aspect of that particular physical assault was that all the scratch marks were in threes. So, you know, if you scratch someone, you get five nails, or you get four if you're just using your fingers and not your thumb. These scratches all over her back and body were just in threes, almost like talons. So we're now looking at something that's a non-human entity that's malevolent, and of course that leads you into some very dark places if you think about that. And we have a pastor on our team, and he suggested that in part he thinks he's seen attacks like this before, where that entity is almost mocking the three of the Holy Trinity, you know, by scratching her in threes like that. So if you're looking, again, for experiences I've had that are now chilling or dark or cause me concern, you know, that would be an aspect where a non-human, perhaps demonic entity actually physically assaulted a member of my team. And there's pictures of her, you know, scratch marks in my book for that particular chapter. And if I can be as bold as to mention just one more, because I've had a lot of experiences in my career, just to end on a nice story rather than one that's malevolent, there's a fabulous town called Manteville, which is going towards the south of Minnesota. It's kind of on the way to, it's past Hastings and just before Rochester, if people know the geography of Minnesota. And Manteville is a fabulous town. It's on a crossroads, and it looks like the town that time forgot. What you've got is all the old boardwalks. It looks like a Western town. It literally, they could use it as a film set for a Western. It's a fabulous looking place. It's very small, but, you know, there's antique shops there, and you can spend a day easily, you know, pottering around looking at souvenir shops and antiques and the like. And they have a theatre there. And again, it was built in 1918, this one, and it's an Art Deco theatre, and it's the Manteville Theatre Company. So I went in to investigate there, and I'm upstairs where the dressing rooms were, and to cut a long story short, I'm running a ghost box, and a gentleman comes through, and he says his name's Bob, and I said, "Hello, Bob, can you just clarify your name is Bob, and it wasn't just a random, you know, snippet off of the radio?" And he said, "No, my name's Bob." And I said, "Do you prefer being called Robert or Bob?" Which is quite a crafty question, because you're getting them to you know, respond again. But if you explain you're a historian and you want to get their name right, then obviously if you've got an ounce of humanity about you, even in the afterlife, you'd step forward and give that information. And he said, no, I'd like to be called Bob. So I said, hi, Bob. And we had a brief conversation. And I said to him, to help me research you, could you tell me your last name? And he said, Sorensen. And I said, so your name's Bob Sorensen? And he said, yes. And we had another kind of conversation that lasted a couple of minutes where we were just discussing why we were there. And he said he wanted to be my friend. And then he said a sentence that was quite chilling at the time, but in hindsight, perhaps wasn't so bad. He said, I'll wait for you. And I said, what do you mean you'll wait for me? Thinking that, you know, he's going to be there when I die. You know, I'd rather see my grandmother, but this strange man called Bob Sorensen going to be waiting for me when I take my last breath. And he said, no, I'll wait for you. And I said, are we friends? And he said, sure. And I said, okay, when I come back, I'll talk to you again. And he said, great. So that was the end of that conversation. I've got all this recorded. I think what I'm going to do at some point in the near future is get all of these recordings and place them on a website so listeners mm-hmm. can actually hear these audio discussions that we captured on our digital voice recorders. So the lady who runs the theatre company, I went to her with all the information I gathered and said, do you know someone called Bob Sorensen? Not thinking for one moment that that's going to register anywhere. And she said, hang on, come with me. So I went with her, and in the auditorium, hanging on the wall, was a series of black and white portraits of all the previous cast and all the previous people that were intrinsic to that theatre company. And there, in a black and white portrait, is a gentleman with a moustache playing the piano from the 1970s. And she said, that's Bob Sorensen. She said he was a fantastic pianist. He used to play the piano for us in the 70s. He's long dead now. He was such a good pianist, apparently, that he used to do most cruises you can go on around the Caribbean and to Florida and places, and he would be the cruise ship pianist, if you like. And, you know, again, it was a stunning moment for me that the information I'd been given, and Bob Sorensen's not like John Smith. It's, you know, you're not going to find too many people, perhaps, you know, with that name. And subsequently, about a year later, I had an opportunity to go back and investigate the Mantoville Theatre again. So I started investigating on the stage, and another part of my team went to do the vigil in the dressing rooms where I had contact with Bob Sorensen. And I'd barely got started in my vigil, and this is something we never normally do. It's almost bordering on unprofessional, but I know why they did it. The team leader of my other team came running down to interrupt our vigil and said, Adrian, you need to get up here. There's a gentleman asking for you. He's asking, where's the Englishman? And he's asking you by name. And I said, well, you did the right thing in coming to get me. So I went back upstairs to the dressing room. And remember, this is a year after my first contact. And I said, it's Adrian here. I'm the Englishman. Who's that? He said, it's Bob Sorensen. He said, I'm really glad you came back. And we had another conversation. And we spoke again like a couple of mates that hadn't seen each other for a year. So, again, you know, the depth in that particular piece of evidence is huge because it suggests there's a knowledge there. It's a suggestion that the person is sentient, has thoughts, has memories, and is omnipresent, that they can remember me from the first time we spoke, and it's historically correct, and it validates all my equipment, it validates all of my research, and incidents like that are just like gold dust. This is the treasure. This is what drives me to be so enthusiastic in everything that I do. These little gems that appear, you know, when I'm doing my work, That can't be argued with. I'd wonder what a skeptic would say about that incident if they'd have been standing with me, and we've got everything recorded. How is someone who's skeptical and doesn't believe in the paranormal argue that away? I mean, I don't know how they could explain that away without it being paranormal. And of course, when I say paranormal, things that are behind the norm, things that, you know, aren't in the fore, stuff that's happening behind the scenes. So, you know, that kind of evidence to me is what's in the book, and is difficult to argue with. And if I'm looking as a paranormal investigator to prove there's an afterlife, you know, this is really good evidence. And, you know, I'm comfortable sleeping in my bed at night now, not too worried if I, you know, make it through to the morning, because I know through my experiences and through my work that this isn't the be-all and end-all of being alive or being sentient. I know that there's stuff that goes on after we're dead, because I've seen it, I've witnessed it, I've had conversations, I've had ghosts telling me how to spell their name so I get it right when I'm going to research them, and they died in 1933. So, you know, this is the kind of work I'm doing. And Llewellyn Press, who's my publisher, the book, by the way, because I haven't mentioned it yet, it's called Mysterious Minnesota, Digging Up the Ghostly Past at 13 Haunted Sites. My publisher, Llewellyn, is really excited about this book because it's unique. Nothing like this has ever been written before. I've seen and I've done research on books that touch upon history and the paranormal, and I've read books that touch upon ghosts and true stories. I've never come across a text like what I've produced in the last 4 years that has such a high level of historical research based on my skills as a historian, and then has such a level of paranormal evidence where one's driving the other and vice versa all the way through the book. And this book couldn't have been written by any other means. This book has got information in it on the history of the Midwest that couldn't possibly have been discovered by any other means. The dead have in fact written this book. All I've done is to research it to make sure what they're telling me is correct. And it has been. This book was written from the other side, in effect.
Wow. I'm so fascinated with everything that you've been saying to us so far. There is one thing that I want to touch on, and it kind of takes away from the paranormal. I understand that you studied in Renaissance art.
That's right, yeah. My specialism, I studied at Kent University, which is in the south of England, and I also studied at London University at Goldsmiths. And as an art historian, my specialism was in Renaissance art, and particularly the early Renaissance. You know, I'm a big fan of artists like Masaccio. I really like the artists that struggled at the very beginning of the Renaissance, that had to do all the hard work, had to do the spade work, which meant that 100 years later, Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci could do what they could do. These were the guys at the beginning that struggled with perspective and invented the concept of perspective and depth. You know, you've got to remember that in the Italian early Renaissance, in the beginning of the 15th century, you know, artists originally were artisans. You know, artists were considered to be chemists. They were in the chemist's guild because back in the day, you know, really early, just after the Byzantine period, when you've just got past Gothic, you know, artists were people that would do stained glass windows, they would do illuminated manuscripts, they would do stone carvings, and they would do tapestries. There was no such thing as an artist, if you like, a cult of personality. And it was people like Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo that came along and said that we were artists and you should be paying us for our skills. And, of course, the more they advertised themselves and the more they put themselves forward in terms of PR meant that they could charge more for their contracts and they'd get more work on the back of that. But the guys I was interested in were the really early ones. That artists like Masaccio died very early when he was 24. And he died of tuberculosis, unfortunately. But there's still a large amount of his artwork left in various frescoes in churches around Florence, for example. So if you go to the Brancusi Chapel, you know, you can see examples of his work. And his most famous work, I would suggest, is in the Santa Maria Novella, which is in Florence. And he started experimenting with perspective. So if you remember back to your art lessons at school, where you draw a vanishing point and you draw a horizon and you make a street or street lamps look like they're disappearing into the distance, that was something he'd come up with. That was his vehicle. That's how he discovered that, in effect, and invented that. And it's amazing to think that there's a psychology of perception, because you've got to remember, we don't see things today like our ancestors saw things. We grow up in today's world and we have Lego to play with as a child. We have G.I. Joes and Barbie. We have video games. We see the world from the moment we're born in three dimensions. We have toys to play with. We have things to look at. We're stimulated visually. Back in the 15th century, you know, there was none of those things. And the time you were old enough, you were getting up in the morning, working in a field, and when it got dark, you came home again. We were so underdeveloped visually. You've got to remember that they saw the world almost in two dimensions. We've developed so much from the psychology of perception aspect that we can't compare what we see to to what people saw in the 15th and 14th centuries. So Masaccio painted on the wall of the Santa Maria Novella a painting called The Holy Trinity, and if people want to look this up, they can do that. It's basically Jesus on the cross, and there's some disciples underneath Jesus looking up at him. There's also a skeleton on the floor to represent fatality and death. But what Masaccio did was, in the background, he painted like there was a room going backwards into the distance. And people came into that church to view that fresco for the first time in the beginning of the 15th century. And they were so taken aback by the fact that it was in 3D that they genuinely thought that they'd built an annex onto the church. And they walked out of the church round the side to see if they'd actually built an extension. And I would imagine, I've been trying to think of examples of how this would be in our world, you know, how it would look to them. But I don't know if you had a similar experience to me, but can you remember the first time you ever saw a hologram and it's 3D and you kind of have to put your finger on it, don't you, to make sure that it's flat? It was quite a unique experience as a kid to see my first hologram, and we see them all over the place now, you know, on credit cards and the like. But, you know, if you can remember back to when you saw your first hologram and how amazed you were, that moment of awe and wonder, and you kind of touch it, don't you, to make sure it's flat and not in three dimensions. That's the same experience our ancestors had, only with paintings that are 3D. So Masaccio invented this technique. He also did something that was very unique. The patrons that were paying for this painting to be done, which was going to assure them an ascent to heaven because they were paying for this, he painted their faces on the disciples. And again, that's one of the first examples ever of portrait painting. No one had ever thought of doing that before or capturing a likeness. So, you know, if you're asking me about the Renaissance and my favorite artwork and the things I've studied, these are the things that excite me and the things that, you know, I look to study and the things I want to go and see. And I travel around the world, you know, looking at this artwork. Intriguingly enough, this particular church had originally frescoes all around it, but what happened was they weren't considered to be important 100 years ago. You know, art history is a fairly modern discipline. People think that art history has been around forever, and it hasn't. The discipline of art history only really started in any kind of detailed way just before the Second World War, when a lot of German art historians came over to Britain to escape Nazi tyranny, and they started the Courtauld Institute. And they wanted to document art history so that Hitler couldn't change history and couldn't change the things that had happened. So they started documenting that. And then the government in Britain passed a law in the 1960s to say that any art-based course, whether it be fine art, graphic design, or theatre set design, or anything else that has creativity in it, has to have an element of art history. And, of course, if you invent that as a subject, that then requires art historians to then be able to teach it. So you're creating jobs in many respects. So art history is a fairly new discipline. It's not been around as long as you would think it has. And of course, back in the day, they didn't think any of these frescoes were that important. So the whole of the church was whitewashed, the interior. And there was a giant wardrobe-type closet in front of the wall. And they just painted around it. And this closet hadn't been moved in 100 years, and someone decided one day to move the closet away from the wall, and behind it was this painting by Masaccio that, if it wasn't for the wardrobe or the cupboard sat in front of the fresco, would have been whitewashed and is now probably one of the most important paintings in the canon of art history. So it's those kind of little stories and those kind of things that excite me, and that's what I studied, and that's what I spent, you know, many, many numbers of years kind of going through churches in Italy and looking at Renaissance art.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, art in general, it fascinates me as it is, but to hear you talk about the Renaissance and the struggles in the beginning, it just piques my interest even more. Jolene, do you have anything you want to ask?
Well, I have something to share if anybody doesn't mind. There is something that I would like to share as far as the paranormal and also a little bit about the history that my son is studying. It's a little bit, you may be familiar with it, but I mean, before I even start, I want to ask, is it okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just disappointed that when you said, "Can I share something with you?" it wasn't a cup of tea or a cake.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm happy for you to discuss whatever you wish. You go for it. It's your show. I'm surprised you managed to get a word in because I've been talking solidly for 50 minutes. So you can have a go now. How's that?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you the first time when you said that. I that's why I said I'm sorry because I didn't hear you. No, I just wanted to share, but I didn't, you know, because I didn't know if Karen had something she wanted to share also, and I didn't want to take, you know, the place. But nevertheless, this was a good 2 or 3 years ago. I live in Williamsburg, Virginia. I know that you know, as the gentleman that you are, that that you travel around the world. You know that Williamsburg, Virginia is a very colonial, historic, artistic town. I call it a town. It's a small city, but with a lot in it, including art and history of all kinds, historic colonial Williamsburg, where everything, I suppose, in the United States began. Well, I only live about 5 minutes from where people from all over the world come to Williamsburg to see it. But there are also back roads and back places, what I call off the beaten road, where there are hauntings, where there are things that are hard to explain to some people who don't understand, and yet you, like myself, if I do understand what I'm seeing, but it's hard to explain to someone who doesn't, and they get scared and they run, which that did happen to me. And we've had the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, you know, all took place here. And in the Civil War, there's a road that extends about 5 miles, and it's called Crawford Road. And in the middle, practically between the 5 mile stretch, is a bridge. There is no beginning. There's no connection, no road on either side. It's just a bridge and nothing more. The rest of it is solid green fields just all over. How it got there, I'll never know. But the story that goes with that is that there was a young black slave who married a Confederate soldier who had fallen in love, and they got married. And that particular night, the lynch mob of the Confederate war against the Union war killed the soldier and hung her from this particular bridge. And now this all is tied in with the history of Williamsburg, and there's an author that has wrote many, many books called The Ghost of Williamsburg. His name is J.P. Taylor, and this is one of his off-the-beaten-path hauntings. And I went there, and I had taken my son, who is studying ancient art and ancient history, and also is very involved with the ancient history of the pyramids, and he studies it quite a lot. He's in college, and he enjoys what he studies, and he's also studying physics. And so combining the both, he has learned quite a lot. And so we went to this bridge, and more, I don't know if it was so much out of curiosity as it was to see it for ourselves. And, you know, when something gets my curiosity like that, I'm not one I can't turn back. I've got to go see it. And we went, and he got out of the car, and he looked up on the bridge, and we both did, and there was a young black girl, and she was walking back and forth across the bridge. And I was looking at her, walking back and forth. Well, he had his phone camera on him. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Taking pictures, Mom." And I said, don't do that without asking. Whatever you do, always ask. That's respect." And he asked out, may I take a picture? And she stood right there and kind of leaned over the bridge, and he caught the picture. Well, everybody wanted to see the picture, but he said, "No, that's between her and I." And he left it that way. That was between her and I, and that was the respect he gave her. Because, and then we left there, and I think my system was a little bit in shock that she let him see her. And I guess as his mother, I stood there in awe. Well, we went back again. This time we had taken Corey and Josh with us. These are two boys that grew up with my son since kindergarten. And they went up the dirt hill and onto the bridge. You had to climb a dirt hill to get to it. And they came running back down, and they were yelling, drive, drive, run, run. I said, I'm not running anywhere. And I got out of the car, and I walked up to the bridge. And I actually looked at her, and I said, "I don't know your name, but I know that you've been here a very, very long time." And I said, "There's a lot of people that come here for the kicks of it, make fun of it, things like that, look for the thrills. I came here to tell you it's time for you to see your family and to cross over. My name is Bright Sun, and I really care whether you are happy." And I said, I'm going to leave now, and I'm going to take everybody with me." And I came home, and I thought about what I saw all night long. And then two nights later, all of a sudden, it was somewhere between midnight and 4 in the morning, I felt somebody pushing my shoulders, it pushing at me. And I jumped up, and I my eyes went wide open, and there was a beautiful, beautiful black lady with a big smile, and she came right up to my face, looked at me as if she hugged me. That's maybe the push that I felt. And I watched her go around the TV because I had been sleeping on the couch because it's more comfortable. And I just watched her, you know, kind of fade away into the night. And I just sat there, and I never forgot her. And I never went back to the bridge after that because I felt like I had done what I was supposed to do. I had asked her to please leave the bridge so that she could find some peace. And I just thought that like you, there are things that stand out, and that was something I never got over. I never forgot it, and I never got over the experience. I never got over the fact that if I helped her, I was really happy inside that I did, it brought me peace to know that kids could no longer make fun of it. And from this point, from that point to this point, from what I understand, there's no longer anything there. People drive down there looking, and there's nothing there anymore. And I'm only hoping that maybe what I did released her spirit. I don't know, but I just wanted to share that because it was so meaningful to me to know that maybe I helped her find her way to her family so that she could find some peace.
These are life-defining moments, and there's a certain sense as well when you have interactions like that, that I said some time ago in the interview that, you know, I have no fear of dying anymore. I mean, there's a fabulous Woody Allen quote, if I may be so bold, and he says, I don't have a fear of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens, which is kind of, you know, my sentiments on things to a certain degree. And, you know, there's times, I mean, a bridge is a fabulous place to find residual energy anyway in terms of the paranormal, because it's focused in that area. If I give you an example, I mentioned earlier that the buildings in Britain and Europe are obviously a lot older than the buildings you have here. There's a church quite close to where my parents live, maybe half an hour's drive away, just on the coast in Essex. And the church dates back to 567. And I'm a historian, and I have problems trying to put an image or trying to put some context on the date 567. It's almost, you know, an impossibility. I'm aware that the Saxons were in Britain at that time, and the Romans, you know, had left by 400 AD. But it's such an abstract figure in many respects that you can't kind of pin anything onto it. It was so long ago. Imagine the residual energy on a bridge, because it's a path that's focused. Everyone has to go over the bridge, so it's a focused energy. Now imagine that residual energy in terms of paranormal activity. If a church was built in 567, and you've got the door to the church, and you've got the door or the gate of the graveyard, and you've got a path between the graveyard gate and the front door of the church, and you've got 1,500 years of residual energy of people constantly walking along the same path. And, you know, you mentioned there was grass around the bridge. I'm sure at some point in the past there was a path there, and it just got overgrown and it is no longer in use, I suspect. But then it reminds me of a nice story. In the 1960s, there's a very old town in Britain that's in the north of England. It's called York. And the Romans were in York, and the Vikings came after that. And so it's a very, very old town. And they've got a city hall building. And a gentleman went down into the basement to work on the electrical system, because the lights were out in the basement, and he was an electrician. So he took his stepladder into the basement of the city hall, which is an old building in itself. And he's standing on his ladder, fixing the electrics. And he looks around, and he sees the residual energy of an entire Roman army walking through the basement. And he said they looked really bedraggled. They looked like, you know, they'd been beaten in a battle, or they'd been on a really long march. He said, you know, their shoulders were hung over.
Right.
You know, they were kind of looking bedraggled, and they were walking side by side each other, two abreast. And he said there was horses and people that were wounded, and they were all dressed in Roman legionnaires' clothing, and the Roman Empire came to Britain in 0 AD, and by 400 AD the Roman Empire had collapsed. So that's the time frame we're looking at. The interesting thing about that residual energy was that he said he only saw the soldiers from the knees up. He didn't see their feet or their shins, if you like, or their calves. He just saw them from the knee up walking through the basement. And he came running out of the basement, and he was white, and obviously slightly disturbed by what he'd seen. And the office workers in the city hall had recognised the fact that this was a regular occurrence, because other people had seen it. And the first thing they said to him was, oh, you've seen the soldiers then. And so what they did later on, in an unconnected incident, they were excavating the basement because they were laying pipes. And what they discovered was that about a foot below the surface of the basement, when they were excavating the basement, they found the remains of a Roman road, and they hadn't known that Roman road was there. So, you know, when he sees the residual energy of a Roman army walking through the basement and he only sees them from the knee up, they were walking on the road that they were meant to be on. It's just that
right.
the basement had been, over the years, you know, had gone a foot higher than the excavation of the Roman road below, which adds weight to his story, because obviously no one was aware of that at the time. That's something that was found out after the event. And you were talking about Virginia, and of course Virginia's name.
Hello?
We've lost Adrian. Let me see if we can get him back on.
Okay. Karen, what did I say wrong?
Oh, you didn't. You didn't. It's just sometimes we lose. Every now and then we lose our guest. It's dropped call is all it is.
Okay.
I want to apologize to everybody, but we'll have Adrian back in just a moment. Okay.
Ladies, I guess I'm back with you. Can you hear me okay?
I hope that you are.
I had to put some more credit on my phone very quickly. You see how quickly I did that?
Wow.
Very fast. Very
did I get up to? Where was I in my story when I got rudely interrupted, ladies?
You were talking about the church and the town of York.
Oh yes, did I tell you the story of the Roman legionnaire that the Roman soldiers that were wandering through?
I believe that was what you were beginning to tell us when the call dropped.
I don't know how far we got into the conversation, but I'll just pick it up very briefly. Is that the electrician was down in the basement of the city hall, and subsequently he saw a residual energy of an entire Roman army walking through the basement, and he only saw them from the knees up, and he came running out of the basement in a state of distress. And this was a common sighting in this particular building, and so people said to him, oh, you must have seen the Roman soldiers. And what I was going on to say was that they excavated the basement sometime after that particular sighting, and they discovered, as they were laying pipework in the basement, that they found a Roman road a foot below the floor of where the basement currently was. So when he said he saw a residual energy of a Roman army walking through, and he only saw them from the knees up, they were actually walking on the Roman road that no one else was aware was there until the basement was excavated sometime afterwards, which obviously, you know, validates his story. But you were discussing battlefields and the Civil War in Virginia. And of course, Virginia is named after Elizabeth I. It's named after the Virgin Queen. And I was discussing the concept that I've done some investigations on battlefields in Britain and Europe, and they're very active places, of course, because you've got a concentration of deaths. And one of the battlefields I investigated that sticks very prominently in my mind is the Battle of Naseby. And Naseby is a small village in Northamptonshire, which is probably about two and a half hours north of London.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during the Civil War. And in the English Civil War, which was in the 1640s, 1650s, in 1645, the Royalists, which were led by Charles I, were having a battle with the Parliamentarians that wanted a republic. And this battle took place in Naseby, and it's one of the bloodiest incidents, you know, in British history. And 30,000 soldiers died on that battlefield, and it's just a battlefield that's a couple of miles square. And what my team did was a very, very impressive piece of research. Whenever you go out with a metal detector, especially battlefields, if you're with a professional team and you're a professional metal detector, if you like, every time you come across a finding, like a musket ball, for example, you have a satellite navigation system, and you press a button, and it registers within a couple of inches, you know, either way, where you are. So any finding instantly gets registered onto a map. So if you go onto certain websites, you can see geometric photographs, geophysical photographs of the battlefield. And if you do further research, you can see all the areas that are flagged where basket balls have been found. And of course, if you're doing an investigation over a 2-square-mile field, you instantly want to go to where all the musket ball finds are, because that's where the heaviest fighting took place at that point. And it was interesting for me in terms of residual energy that all the way through the night we were investigating, and it was the anniversary of that particular battle as well, to the very day. And all the way through our audio recordings, you could hear gunshots going off as a residual sound. Because guns are banned in Britain. I've never seen a gun. I've never owned a gun. If I was found with a gun in my possession, I'd get 15 years in prison. So guns aren't common. Farmers might have them to get rid of vermin, but they have to have so many different licenses and go through so many, so much paperwork and bureaucracy. They're very rare. Even our police force doesn't carry guns. And so, it's odd that you're listening to gunshots going off constantly on your EVPs, but there's no guns going off. No guns went off that night. We didn't hear any. And we took a fabulous photograph of that particular evening where you can see the ghostly figure of a soldier dressed in period armour with a footman's pike in his hand. It looks exactly like the kind of armour that the Roundheads would have been wearing, as part of the forces that took place in that battle. And, I can't emphasise enough how appallingly bad. You talk about the Battle of Gettysburg and then the Civil War and the 600,000 Civil War soldiers that died during the American Civil War. 400,000 of those were through illness and dysentery and, various illnesses and diseases. But during the English Civil War in the 1640s, 1 in 3 people in the whole of Britain died. So, imagine losing an entire third of your workforce or an entire third of your population, due to these conflicts. But, if you're talking about battlefields, that's one that sticks in my mind from Britain. That was a nice little investigation we did that got some really good evidence for us.
Where I live in Williamsburg, there are battlefields all over that are very, very old. And right, in fact, across the road from me, there's still a battlefield. Of course, it's in a tree line now, but it's still there. You can walk around it and so on. It's untouched, and it will, I guess, always be that way, because people here, when they build, they will not build around any historic sites. And of course, Williamsburg is full of battlefields, and Yorktown and so on. And when you mentioned musket ball, I took a deep breath, because my son, when he was younger, he was sitting down on the ground. The ground to which I live on has never been dug. The homes are made on top of the ground, not dug underneath. Everything is on top. And so the grounds have never been touched. And then across the highway from me is a plantation called Carter's Grove Plantation. And there's an old country road that the slaves and the settlers and American Indians used to go from this area to historic colonial Williamsburg, what for their supplies and what have you, or a doctor, whatever they needed, they would travel this by horseback. And all I have to do is walk across the road, and that old country road is there, and everything there is untouched. But my son was digging one day, and he was close by the battlefield, and he came home, and he had a little round ball in his hand, and he looked at me, and he said, "Mom, what is this?" And I said, "Where did you find that at?" And he said, "Over at the battlefield over there." He said, "The creek. We call it the creek because a lot of the kids play there, but they don't touch anything." And he said, "I was digging, and I guess I said, you dug far enough." And I said, "Robert, it's a musket ball." And he said, "From long, long ago?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, and I put it away in a baggie. I have it put safely away today, and it is a round musket ball from the Civil War. And when you said that, I just went like that, because I found, Robert found the musket ball, and from that point on, his interest in the history around James City County, Williamsburg, historic colonial Williamsburg, Jamestown, where the settlement is, and the island, and so on, all of it has history on it, and spirits, many spirits. The old country road, he's walked that alone because he's a tracker, and he's walked that alone and told me there were many times where the spirits actually there, because he shows no fear and he's not afraid, so they basically reach out to him. And he said it's an amazing thing, and so I walked some of it with him, and it does something to your own spirit to be able to know that they know you're not afraid, and that you can actually say my name is and what your name is. And that's how I have always approached these spirits. And then at one point, they have ghost tours in historic colonial Williamsburg, and one of the ghost tour guides called me and said, "Jolene, are you busy tonight? I'd like for you to come out here and walk with us. I have a large bus group that has come to see Williamsburg. I'd like for you to participate in this." So I went, and I took my son with me, and it's called the Skipwith House, and Miss Skipwith was a very eccentric, very, very eccentric lady, very wealthy. Her clothes and her home was probably one of the most wealthy in historic colonial Williamsburg. And she's a very rare type of lady of that time. And I happened to feel something down by the doorknob. I wasn't supposed to go up on the steps and feel it, but I did. And his name is Mike, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I don't know. I said, I can feel something breathing. I said, it's kind of strange, but I'm not afraid. And he said, "Well, you better get up, because we're going to get in trouble." And I said, "Well, I'm not afraid." And so all of a sudden, I felt a tug. I had a denim blue jean jacket on, and I felt a tug at the jacket, and it was right at the collar, and I had a lapel pin on the collar. And sure enough, the security came along and said, "What is she doing?" And Mike said, "She can't get loose, because Miss Skipwith has got her jacket." And and she did. She had pulled my jacket, and I said to her, "It's called denim." I said, "I know it's strange to you." I said, "Miss Skipwith," and I told her my name, and I said, it's very nice to be, you know, she wanted to feel the clothes, because I'm sure they looked different. And it was an experience to this day that he hasn't forgotten. He still talks about the time Miss Skipwith pulled my denim jacket, and he still tells other audiences that come about that I was there and my jacket got pulled. So there are spirits all over, and it's how you approach them, you know, it's as if you talk to them as if they're in physical form. And that's, there are so many experiences that other people have had in this area that I guess a long, large book could be written if everybody could tell their stories. But that was something that really took me by surprise, is when my jacket got pulled and I was, you know, trying to get loose, and the security man was just standing there, and he had a bicycle, and he was tapping his foot, and I can't get loose. And I was like, I was looking at him like, please don't put me in jail, you know. But he told them that, you know, I was doing what he asked me to do, and that was to say hello to her. And they say if you say hello to her, you know, that she'll come to the door. And so it's an extraordinary place. It has so much, and there are all kinds of plantations all the way to the Chickahominy River that people have gone to investigate, a lot of investigations, and stayed overnight and things like that, and gone to not so nice places. There are a few that aren't so pleasant, that do have some evilness to it. I guess that's the only way to say it. But I've been to those places, and I never did return because I didn't like the negative energy. So I stay away from it. But I just thought, you know, that musket ball, when you said that, it just made me gasp, because I've got that musket ball put safely away.
The mysterious, the mischievous side of me, you know, thinks that you were quite lucky, because if you was a ghost, wouldn't you go around pantsing people and doing things like that? I mean, you could have been pantsed at the end of the day, so I guess you were lucky if you just grabbed hold of your jacket.
Yes, at the time she was pulling on my jacket, I was talking to her. You know, I'm American Indian, as Karen is, and you know, and I always, you know, prefer to be called Bright Sun, and I was telling her, you know, that was my name, and it was amazing to be there. And Mike took us to a graveyard that was right next to her house, and it's in back of the old, the church is extremely old, just like the one at Jamestown Island is. Actually, the real one is down below, and you could actually look down on the floor and see it. Was the one that Pocahontas, they have her picture when she was became Christian, with her Christian name Rebecca. And he said that if you rattle the cage door, the metal doors to the church, a little boy, his name is Matthew, a little boy will come eventually if you ask him, does he want to play? Well, we asked him to do it. You know, I kind of wanted to see it, but I wasn't the one who asked. It was the whole audience that asked. So he did it. And he said, Matthew, do you want to come and play? Do you want to come and play? And about a few minutes went by, and I went, I don't think Matthew wants to come. And all of a sudden, as soon as I said that, you saw that it was like, as you described, a mist. And it came around some pine trees that are planted in the graveyard. The graveyard, all the I don't want to call them caskets, but they're cement, and they're on top of the ground. They're not buried inside the ground, they're all on top, and they're cracked and they're old. And he came around in kind of like a flash to me, but it was white, misty kind of white. And sure enough, he answered Mike's call, and I just stood there, and my son started talking to him. And my son was just telling him we had come to visit, and, you know, maybe sometime when the gates were open, he would come in and he would sit down and talk to him and play, because Robert has that ability to just talk, whether it's in spirit, because he lost his uncle last year, and he talks to his uncle quite often. And it was an extraordinary experience to see all the people actually gasp when he showed up at the gate that he had rattled, and it was a really very, very interesting, and all the streets are cobblestone, all of them. They're nothing has been touched, and it's just a very, very spiritual way to walk around and hear the ghost stories from the ghost tour guides that can tell you the history of each building and who lived there and so on. And so, but that, you know, I've always felt like a little bit of a kindred spirit with her because she had my jacket and it was pulling on it a little bit, and ever since then, that jacket, actually, it means quite a bit to me. And when I look at the collar, and I always smile because she reached out to me. So it just meant a lot to me.
It's interesting, going back to the musket ball, that one of the reasons there were so many deaths during the Civil War was the invention of new ammunition. And you may have heard of the mini ball, which was developed just before the Civil War, but used during the Civil War, and it's quite a heavy piece of shell, if you like. It's called a mini ball, but it's not actually a ball. It is actually in a traditional shape of what you'd consider to be a shell, but it had grooves in it, and it's such a heavy kind of shell or bullet, if you like, that it was responsible for just disintegrating and shattering bones, and it changed the way in which warfare took place. You could no longer, you know, charge the enemy or go into battle, you know, facing each other, because that piece of ammunition was just wrecking bones and shattering flesh. And I read that if you fired a mini ball out of a rifle, it had such velocity and weight to it that even at 400 yards, it would penetrate two planks of wood together. So the reason there were so many amputations during the Civil War, it would just shatter the bones, and then they'd have to amputate because there'd be too great a risk for secondary infections. And you mentioned Pocahontas there. Pocahontas is actually buried in England. I don't know if you were aware of that.
Yeah.
And, she came to visit London, and unfortunately she succumbed to syphilis, and as many Native Americans, you know, suddenly succumbed to Western European diseases like smallpox and the like. But she was taking a ship back to the Americas, and she became ill on board the ship and died just as the ship was leaving the Thames Estuary to go into the English Channel to go around the south of England back to America. And, of course, the last thing they wanted to do was to have a dead, diseased body on board for such a long journey with the chance of spreading disease throughout the ship. So the last possible chance they had to drop her body off was a small, sleepy little town called Gravesend. And so Gravesend is in Kent, which is the university I went to, and there's a little memorial to her. And I was surprised the first time, you know, you don't think, do you, that you know, people like Pocahontas, you know, for any would be buried in a small sleepy town in the Thames Estuary, but you know she is. And you know, one of the things that I found in my book is that going to all of these sites, you know, I want to find out. You know, in my conclusion, I'm writing about why, you know, paranormal events happen in these sites over any other places. Why should one site be more haunted than any other? And, of course, as you're probably aware, the Sioux Uprising took place in Minnesota in 1862, and it's 150 years, you know, almost to the week. In actual fact, it's quite chilling talking about that now, because I would suggest it's almost to the week, 150 years ago today, that the Sioux Uprising took place in Minnesota, and the stockades were built very quickly, and there was a lot of bloodshed, and, you know, places like New Ulm, you know, suffered terrible massacres. And, of course, you know, what then took place was the Native American Indians were rounded up, and then, as you're probably aware, there was a mass execution of 30-odd Native Americans in Mankato, where they hung them all at once. And, you know, the whole episode, no one looks good on either side, to be honest. There's an outsider and a foreigner looking in. But one of the things I discovered is that if I looked at all the buildings that I investigated, there were some common themes, and one of those themes amongst many was the Native American aspect, because places I investigated, like the St. James Hotel in Red Wing, you know, and Red Wing's called Red Wing because the first chief there, you know, had a swan's wing with him that was dyed red, so it was called Red Wing, and he was Chief Red Wing.
Yes.
But there's burial mounds everywhere. And, you know, back in the day, there was absolutely no respect for the Native American dead. And so the St. James Hotel, when they were digging out the basement, they stumbled across burial mounds, and there was bodies, you know, that they were coming across. And they didn't stop digging. They just continued. And I don't know what happened to those bodies. You would like to think that they were dealt with in a respectful way, but judging from previous history I've read, I suspect they were probably just thrown in the lake or dumped somewhere. And one of the ghosts that I saw, and members of my team saw, that I've documented in the book, is in the St. James Hotel, and the staff claim to see a floating head, a floating Native American head. And one of my team members actually saw this apparition. And you know when you see a cartoon and you see someone's teeth chattering together and they're shivering through fright? Well, that actually happened. Her name was Angela, and she saw this floating apparition of a head, and I knew she'd seen something because I rushed to where she was, and her teeth were literally clattering together, and she was shivering with fright. And this is a seasoned, you know, paranormal investigator, but I would challenge anyone not to succumb to an element of fright when presented with a floating apparition of a head. And she said that the head looked Native American. It was darker in skin, dark eyes, long black hair, you know, as a sort of kind of stereotypical kind of look for a Native American or a Sioux up in this particular area.
Right.
And you can easily imagine that when they were excavating those bodies to build the basement of this old hotel, that the head probably came detached from the body. And you can easily imagine a head looking for the body almost, and wondering where the body went to a certain degree. And it's almost, it's worth considering as well that in amongst the atrocities, you know, the British and the French, going back several hundred years before this, would actually pay a bounty, you know, for every head of a Native American that could be found or taken as a trophy. They actually paid for. So decapitations, you know, were rife on both sides. I mean, as a retaliation, the Native Americans would behead any fur trappers or French or English settlers that were in this area. And of course, they did the same in return. So, you know, any number of causes can do that, but, you know, create a floating head, if you like. But interesting that you mentioned your Native American culture and upbringing when that was quite prominent in all the sites I've been to.
I'm very proud of it. I my father comes from the Southwest, and we're Northern Cheyenne and Chiricahua Apache, and he has some bloodline of Lakota Sioux. My mother, on the other hand, is Coeur d'Alene from the Idaho Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation, and she is Dakota Sioux. And so I grew up from the time I was little until today knowing my culture, learning my culture. My father taught me. He was a wonderful teacher. He died 2 years ago. He couldn't have taught me enough. I only wish he was here to teach me more. I know enough to where I can go anywhere. I've done so many programs all over the East Coast with my brother. I've done storytelling. I've done lectures. Everything. I enjoy people. I enjoy teaching them our heritage. And in return, when I had my son, the first thing we did was put him in a sweat lodge, and he grew up with our culture at the powwows. He was taught by many, many, many elders who were determined for him to be the next generation, because he was born the seventh generation. So, therefore, his knowledge of his own culture today is absolutely amazing for a young man his age. And when Pocahontas, their reservations is Mattapani and the Pinunki in West Point. Both reservations claim Pocahontas. I guess she maybe shifted in between both of them. They're right across the highway from each other. The Pinunki pretty well stay to themselves. They don't really invite you to come in. They're very private people. Whereas the Mattapani people are very open and they have powwows and they're friendly. They want you to learn. And her original necklace that she wore, which they put on the animated movie of Pocahontas, that when she went to Grandmother Willow and she had the necklace on, that original necklace is in the Mattapani Museum. And it's so fragile, it looks like if you just touched it, it would crack. And they've got it in a glass case, and the floors have never been redone. They're clay hill, and it's an amazing little reservation with wonderful, warm, kind, loving people. And I'm very close to all of them there, but you know, our history, to me, extends all over the United States. I don't just stay, you know, I'm very attached to the Southwest and to Pine Ridge and Rosebud up there. And I care very deeply for the Eastern Woodland natives. And my son's father is from the Eastern Woodlands, so it's amazing in a sense to know where you belong and know that you've had the right teachers to teach you the proper culture and the right way of everything that needs to be taught. And it's a responsibility to take that knowledge and share it with people that are truly interested in our heritage in every way, in every tribe. And that's basically what I do. I have learned so much from my own father that and elders that he knew, many elders that were 80 and 90, that taught me so much that I'm able to do what my father wished most of all, and that was to keep teaching. And that's what I do now when I go and I do programs. And sometimes our audiences are 500 people in one auditorium, and they think 500 people is a lot. And to me, I would welcome 700 because I love a large audience. And my brother did the same thing I did, and he traveled across the United States from Virginia to California, and he did programs. His name was Red Hawk. And he did programs everywhere, and he passed away. It'll be 1 year this Thanksgiving night, and it's not going to be an easy evening for me. But his spirit is very much with us. I miss him very much, and but I know that I can step out my front door, go stand underneath my tree, and say his name, and I know that he's listening. And I always tell him every night that I love him, and my dad is watching over him. And so he and my father are together. And but all the same, it's what you learn, what you've taken in. And As Karen has, you know, absorbed so much in the last few years, you know, not only from me but from all elders, and her knowledge is great. And so it's something that we will always continue to do as long as we're here.
One of the concepts I read about that I was very interested in, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, of course, because my knowledge of Native American culture, you know, as an Englishman is going to be thin, but I really like the concept of doing a dance after taking part in a battle, because, you know, in Minnesota, there's many recidivists that have been here in the past in the Wild West. We had Cole Younger and Jesse James up here. Jesse James, you know, actually died after doing a bungled bank robbery in Northfield, which is in Minnesota, and Cole Younger of the Younger James gang was imprisoned in Stillwater up here, and then went on a tour of all the hotels and all the theaters after he was let out of prison, and continually toured Minnesota, and his ghost has been seen in various places as well. And then you consider, you know, that there was a run between Chicago and Minneapolis for the gangsters during the Prohibition. So John Dillinger, you know, had a shootout in Minneapolis and was constantly in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then you had the Mar Barker gang, you know, kidnapping various officials and various businessmen in and around St. Paul and Minnesota. So all these people, you know, General Sheridan, for example, and General Hancock, you know, came up here to engage with the forts and look at the fort building process during the Sioux Uprising and stayed in many of the hotels. And these people, you know, were so prominent on the battlefield that I'm, you know, the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, General Hancock took the left flank at the Battle of Gettysburg and was very well considered. So all these people have taken lives, they've murdered people, they've killed people on the battlefield. And every time they stay somewhere, I'm sure the energy that they have around them of all the souls that they've, from the people they've killed. It was interesting for me that in Native American culture, they would do dancing or combined with prayer after a battle, you know, to try and absorb themselves of the souls of the people they'd murdered or killed in the course of battle, which I found very interesting, where those figures from history I've just spoken about in Minnesotan culture, you know, wouldn't have done that or been aware of that.
Right. It's I know that my father's heritage even connects to Billy the Kid. I found that out through his family when they told me that we were, you know, Billy the Kid had Apache blood in him. That's how we became my son, myself, my father, descendants of Billy the Kid. I'm very proud of it, simply because my son is every bit of his character in many, many ways. But Billy had an insight for different tribes in the Southwest, and my father taught, you know, he taught me much about the outlaws of the West, and you know, and Jesse James being one of them, very much. And I'm trying to think, Earl White, he's another one that my father taught me about. And a person say they can only absorb so much, you know, before you feel like your head's going to blow up, but that's not true. I never stop absorbing, and I taught Robert that never stop taking it in. And that's, you know, and now in college he's at the top of his class, and I'm actually shocked, because for the longest time his home was in the woods tracking, you know, whether it be animals or people. He even helped the police department at one time, you know, but now, you know, he has his course has changed, and he's matured and he's growing up, and it's really something to see that he's picking up where his uncle Red Hawk left off, and he's determined to make sure that the memory and the teachings are still alive and still there. And there was one instance where we all had went to Walmart, and I had called Robert's name about six times right in the store, and he never, and he was only about 20 feet ahead of us, and he never once turned around. And everybody that was with us that had jumped in the car and said, well, I want to go too, so they went. And I kept saying, Robert, and I didn't get any response, and I don't know what made me do it. It was just pure instinct, but I up and I went, Billy. And he swirled around within seconds and turned and looked at me. And they all stood there and they went, what? And like that. And I said, "You, why did you answer to Billy?" And he said, I don't know, like that. And I said, but you did. And later on, I talked to a lady, and she said it was because his inner spirit is very much intact with Billy the kid, and Billy basically in many ways still has his spirit, and he chose Robert to carry it on. And it's kind of amusing sometimes, because my son does have a little tendency to be he'll get into mischief every now and then again. And I'm not one of the whole say my child is perfect. He's not, and he has that tendency because of his curiosity. And but nevertheless, he also knows how to get out of trouble, which fascinates me to watch him do that, because it's exactly the way that Billy got out of trouble. And so you know, a gentleman wrote a book not too long ago, The Last Ride, and it was about Billy, and I think he lives in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And I always wanted so much to talk to him, because my father's family is so proud of the fact that there are ties to Billy. And it's just really, you know, it's something how history, whether it be ancient history from long ago, as you mentioned, the UFOs, and or history that is being made today, people need to grasp every bit of that from then until now, and be able to know that they have experienced every inch of it. And that's just, you know, that's the way that I guess I've taught when I've gone to different programs, and you know, and hoping that people listened and took it all in.
Well, Billy the Kid is definitely an interesting topic. I know we're coming down to the last part of the show, and I wanted to give you time to put all of your websites out, because I know you do have several websites, Adrian.
That's very kind of you. Yeah, I've got some websites. If people want to, the book, of course, is called Mysterious Minnesota. If you type that in, you'll find it. My name's Adrian Lee. That's L-E-E. So Mysterious Minnesota, digging up the ghostly past of 13 haunted sites throughout the Midwest. I know it's being sold in all the bookshops, Barnes and Noble, and it's on Amazon. If you're outside of the Midwest, then obviously, you know, your best chance of getting that would be online. If people want to contact me and my team, we're the International Paranormal Society, and our website is INT Paranormal. So INT is a shortening of international, intparanormal.net on that one. If people want to talk to me after this particular radio show, or in the future, or want to discuss anything with me, if they go to mysteriousminnesota@yahoo.com.uk, of course, because I'm from the United Kingdom. So mysteriousminnesota@yahoo.com.uk, they can look for me there. I have lots of events coming up in the next month or so, and I'll just go through some of those briefly. I'm a clairvoyant, of course, and I do readings. So if people want to contact me for a reading or for clairvoyancy or tarot work, they can go to heavenandearthessentials.com and they can book me from there. And I'd be willing to do those over the phone, or if people want to come and visit me, they're welcome to do so. That's at heavenandearthessentials.com. Just very briefly, I've got with Halloween coming up, of course, you know, everyone wants to know a paranormal investigator and wants interviews and so forth. I'm actually doing an investigation with my team, and I'm inviting members of the public along. If anyone's interested in meeting me and my team, on the 29th of September, in Sauk Center, which is right in the middle of Minnesota, I'm doing an investigation in a building that's an old pharmacy, and it dates back to 1871, and it's such a haunted building. The evidence that we've gathered here in the past, the video footage of things moving around and the EVPs, are actually going to be on an episode of my ghost story in the fall. And so that's something that people can look out for. And if they want to come on the investigation with me and my team on the 29th, they can go to heavenandearthessentials.com, and the phone number and the dates are on there. And then very briefly, on the 26th to the 28th of October, my team again is doing a series of lectures and an investigation over a weekend at the Chase Resort, which is in Walker, and Walker's near Bemidji on Leech Lake, and it's a fabulous five-star resort, and they're letting us have the entire run of the hotel for the weekend. And again, it's a very haunted building. It was used as a morgue during the last contact between the U.S. Army and the Native American Indians in 1904, when they actually massacred several soldiers there. The soldiers had it coming, to be honest, but you know, it was used as a morgue. I don't know if it's where you are, it's probably warmer, but in the Midwest here, Midwest prairies, it's so cold in the winter that to bury anyone in the ground, you have to light a fire first. And over a period of days, you rake the hot coals over the ground to defrost the ground to get the body in. The trouble is that if 12 soldiers die in a day, or there's a diphtheria epidemic, and a group of, you know, a family or two dies during the course of that week, they have to store the body somewhere because they can't light enough fires to get the ground defrosted in such a short period of time. So a lot of these hotels and a lot of these theatres and buildings I've investigated have been used as temporary morgues during the winter just because the ground's too hard, you know, to get any of the bodies in at that time. So again, that was something that was prominent, you know, in my book and in the work that I've been doing.
Wow, I think it's fantastic that you're doing so much work as far as the paranormal goes, plus your knowledge on many, many other topics as well. We're going to have to definitely have you come back on, because I know there's so much more that we didn't cover this evening.
Sure. Well, we barely scratched the surface, to be honest. We could do a couple of hours just on the difference between investigating in Europe and investigating in America. And as you know, I do a whole series of lectures for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, on UFOs in Renaissance art. And I'm currently in the process of planning a book with a gentleman called Ted Phillips, who's one of the leading ufologists in the country. And we're writing a book together on the fact that we believe UFOs and ghosts can actually be the same thing. And we have some theories on quantum physics and quantum footprints and portals and shadow figures, where UFOs and ufologists share the same kind of experiences as I'm having, you know, looking for ghosts in basements and old buildings. So I think there's a lot we can cross over on there. And, it, you know, can you imagine writing a book called, you know, UFOs and ghosts, are they the same? You know, that's the kind of dream ticket, isn't it, having the two combined as one. So, you know, it's nice to be working with such an expert in his field in UFOs. And I'm offering my paranormal knowledge, you know, to hopefully make that text happen for next year.
I'm definitely fascinated with the combination of the UFOs and the paranormal combined. I've often wondered about that myself. So I'm looking forward to finding out what you find about that. I think it's probably going to be interesting and probably going to change the field for paranormal around lot once all that comes out.
If you have me back, I'll certainly be able to talk for a couple of hours and all the things that UFOs and ghosts have got in common. And I think by the end of that interview, you know, I'll be giving a lot of people food for thought on, you know, why ghosts appear. And we were talking earlier about, you know, the fact that, you know, you were talking about culture and going back in time. You know, isn't that what ghosts are? It's time travel. If, God forbid, I died today, you know, I'd be coming back in 80 years' time, when a team in 80 years' time would be investigating this building. If I'm investigating this building and I'm getting people from the 1920s, wouldn't that suggest if I died today that in another 90 years' time, I'll be around when they're investigating me? So there are elements of time travel involved in all of this as well, and it's a really interesting concept, something that hasn't really been spoken about before. And, you know, we've got a lot of interesting data on this and a lot of interesting facts that I don't think, you know, have been put into the public arena before.
It is a lot of interesting facts. I've wondered, I'm going to throw something out that I've thought of, you know, what if it's more or less just two worlds? I mean, what if we're here and then our spirits just travel on to another world totally, and they're living their lives as though they were never here in the beginning, and there's just a tear in the realm, so to speak, and occasionally we're able to see and hear them. And if that's possible...
You're absolutely right. And if I may be as bold as to take 30 seconds of your time before we end here, UFOs tend to just appear, and then they move around randomly without necessarily seeing the journey between A and B. They just appear in A, and then they appear in B. Wouldn't it suggest that as some sort of collective thought around a central console in a UFO, you can think you want to be somewhere, so you then are, because you can't travel those vast distances. It's too far to travel, you know, 20 billion light years. So they must have some sort of concept. And people that have been abducted always say that there's a central console with aliens around it, but they're not actually touching levers and knobs. So I believe the power of collective thought as a quantum footprint can put you somewhere where you can observe and be seen, but you're not actually there. You're in another dimension and another plane. Now take that to ghosts. If a ghost wants to be where it used to work in the 1920s, and the only thing it's got left behind is flesh and bones in a grave, you know, it's using the same process. It's thinking it wants to be there, so it is. In the same way that a UFO thinks it wants to be there, so it is. And that ties up so many loose ends in terms of travel, in terms of distances, in terms of how ghosts are here. And I'm barely scratching the surface in the seconds I have left. But that's the basis of a lot of what we're doing. And it's quantum physics. They're called quantum footprints. And our research is around those concepts.
I think I find it very fascinating. And, you know, it's something that I think that we as investigators are going to have to dig a little deeper into to compare notes, you know, and I think with MUFON, with what they have found with their research for UFOs, you know, I don't see anything wrong with putting the two together. I think that they may find more information and maybe more answers that way.
It was amazing for me that when I met the gentleman, Ted Phillips, who's one of the top ufologists, that the more he talked, the more I had the same experiences as him. He's seeing orbs and light anomalies. When he has a UFO landing site, the paranormal activity in that area is juiced up and there's more hauntings after that event. We talked about portals. We talked about using the same equipment. We talked about shadow figures and dark mass and how light doesn't get through. And we talked about jumping in history and suddenly... You know, there's a whole myriad of things that we've both got in common, whereas normally the paranormal investigator and the ufologist wouldn't touch or wouldn't be together on these things.
Wow. Well, I definitely want you back on air with us to talk more, because tonight has been it's been amazing. I've enjoyed listening to you talk, and I cannot wait to hear what you have to say on the next show. I will give you a call. I don't know, maybe later this evening, but I'm in awe of your studies and what you found.
That's very kind of you. I appreciate you having me on board. And as I said, you know, at a future date, hopefully soon, I can talk about, you know, more ghost experiences. I can tell you more stories from the book. And as you know, I do a lecture for MUFON on UFOs in Renaissance art, which is bizarre when you start seeing satellites and spaceships in paintings from the 14th and 15th century. So I also do work with angels and the history of angels. So, you know, I'd be glad to come back, and I'm sure we could easily get through another couple of hours without too much bother.
Oh, I'm sure.
I just wanted to say I wanted to thank you, sir. You're a very noble, very, very honorable man to speak with, and I will not forget sharing this evening with you in conversation. Thank you.
That's very kind of you, sweetheart. I love listening to the stories, and I appreciate the time you've given me, and you know full well that us Brits are very polite and very well-mannered.
Thank you. That's very kind. But I when I first heard you speak, I told Karen, I said that it is a very noble gentleman, and you know, and I when I meet someone such as yourself, I take that characteristic in, and I hold it forever, because you have a very very thoughtful, very noble, very honorable way of yourself in the way you carry yourself, and I see you as that way, and I wanted to thank you for teaching through these 2 hours of what you have. You know, like you said, we barely scratched the surface, but nevertheless, you have taught so much within just these 2 hours. Thank you.
Well, again, that's very kind of you. And if I can just leave on this, my dad said to me when I was young, you know, if you can be interesting and interested, then you've achieved many things. So hopefully my dad would be proud of me on that. So thank you very much.
Yes. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yes. Definitely. Thank you, and I appreciate it. It's been a fantastic 2-hour show. I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and join us next week, and we'll see you then. Everybody have a good night. Good night, Adrian, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night, all.
Good night.